You're listening to Guts and Glory, the SGH Gastroenterology Podcast. Good afternoon and welcome to the Guts and Glory Singapore General Hospital Gastroenterology Podcast. I'm Dylan.
I'm Ching Han.
And I'm Andrew.
And we are your hosts for this podcast.
All right, so we're still trying to adjust to being more natural over a podcast, right? So being Asians and being Singaporeans specifically, I think we're always finding it a bit awkward to talk to, even to each other in a recorded setting. So it takes a while to get used to these things. Now, I don't know how much the audience wants to hear us talking about ourselves, but it makes sense to just be a bit more natural, ease ourselves into the conversation. So I think what would be interesting for me to find out is, Dylan, anything has been interesting happening in your life recently?
So, I mean, with all of the tightening COVID restrictions over the past few months, I think a lot of gym, as well as a lot of exercise areas have started to close. So recently I've picked up rollerblading as a sport just to get outside, get a bit of fresh air, do some activities outside. So I own a dog. It's a multi-poo. It's about 8 years old now. And over the past year, actually, it's been becoming progressively or rapidly blind because of some congenital condition. So he's almost like maybe 50%, like 70% blind at this point. So he can't really walk outside. So recently I bought a pram off of Amazon Prime. So it's like a dog walking pram where you put your dog on the pram, then you can push it. So I got one that's equipped for somebody to run with, or I guess in my case, rollerblade with. So I put it to the test over the weekend yesterday. So yeah, I went down to Marina Bay and then I put my dog on the pram and then I rollerbladed while he was in the pram. Yeah, it was quite enjoyable. Yeah, and it's very easy also because I don't have to worry about, you know, whether he can keep up or whether he wants to go and smell some lamppost or whatever. I can just put him in a pram, push him along, and then I'll just rollerblade like my usual route. Yeah, so that's what I've been up to lately. Yourself, anything interesting?
Well, I have two young kids, for those of you who know. So I have a daughter who's 7 and a son who's 5. So they keep me busy on most days, most hours, most minutes. But other interesting things I noticed is I managed to find this podcast recently from Duke students called Rounding the Blues. I think it's by two students, Arthur Bu and Chu Xian. And I listened to a few of the episodes. I think they've had 3 episodes so far. It's very, very well done. So, I mean, if they are listening to this podcast, kudos to them. Other interesting things for me, basketball season is coming. So those of you who watch the NBA, I've always been an NBA fan. So it's coming. I've been reading a lot about it. And so looking forward to that. Right. But let's head back straight to our topic today. And today we have a special guest. So Dylan, why don't you introduce our guest today?
Okay, so today we have Dr. Ravi. He's a consultant gastroenterologist from Singapore General Hospital who specializes in advanced endoscopic procedures. Dr. Ravi, would you like to introduce yourself to our audiences?
Hi, guys. Thank you, Andrew and Dylan, for having me for this podcast. I'm Dr. Ravi Shankar Ashokumar, consultant with the Department of Gastroenterology and Hepatology. My area of interest is in interventional endoscopy. So I manage patients with GI bleeding, cancers, resection of cancers, colonoscopy, and bariatric endoscopy. I did my advanced training in Spain, which is where I honed my skills in endoscopic therapies and bariatric therapies. And since my time back in Singapore, it's been more than a year, we have successfully established a bariatric endoscopic center in Singapore General Hospital. Thank you again for having me.
Okay, so as custom to what we've been doing in the last few episodes, right? So I generally will talk about the guests, about how they are, as my understanding of them as a work colleague, and whether they have any special powers, right? So just a bit of sharing about for Ravi. So Ravi and I, we were fellow senior residents in our training program. So we trained together. And one of the things that people may not be aware of is Ravi is a very bold endoscopist. Okay? So in our department, in gastroenterology, hepatology, you have people with very differing risk appetites. Okay, so we have some of them like myself, who we are wussies, right? And we tend to to go with the easier stuff. And that's why we end up doing things that are not so fast-paced, not so life-threatening, like motility, functional GI disorders. Ravi is the other extreme. Right? So he's an adrenaline junkie. He's the kind who sees a clip on an ulcer and will shear it off just to see what happens so that he can do something about it. Right. So because of that, he's on my speed dial. In case I have a very catastrophic GI bleeding for my bleeder calls, he's always there to build me up. Now, what people may not know is that as Ravi is talking to us now in this podcast, he actually is waiting for a call by the OT to actually call him in for a bleeding patient. So how apt that we actually have such a story to actually describe. Okay, so Dylan, would you want to introduce us to the case?
Today we're going to talk about variceal bleed, and we have a case vignette that we'll be going through. So to start off, you know, we have Mr. Billy Ding. He's a 57-year-old Chinese male with newly diagnosed Child's B cirrhosis, secondary to chronic hepatitis B. He has been brought to the emergency department by his family as they had noticed black stools over the past 2 days. Initial labs show a hemoglobin of 9.3, total whites of 10.1, as well as a platelet count of 87. Dr. Ravi, what are some of the pertinent points in the history and physical examination that, you know, one should look out for?
So as we know, a decompensated patient has systemic manifestations or multi-organ dysfunction when they present to hospital with GI bleeding. We have to approach this patient holistically. We need to look for symptoms such as what type of presentation do they have. If they present with hematemesis, do they present with melena? Most of the time when patients with cirrhosis present with bleeding, it's going to be hematemesis. Because 70% of the decompensation when it happens in patients with cirrhosis is going to be from variceal bleed. Well, does that mean that patients with cirrhosis cannot bleed from anything else? No. Patients with cirrhosis can also bleed from conditions like peptic ulcer disease. 30% of the patients with cirrhosis, when they present with bleeding, presents from an ulcer bleed. So an accurate history becomes very much crucial when we try to evaluate patients for GI bleeding. So such as in this case, the patient presented with melena. Then when we have to assess this patient, there is a confusion here whether this patient is bleeding from ulcer or this patient is bleeding from varices. Does this differentiation make a big difference? I would say in a patient, irrespective of what is the etiology of bleed, when they have underlying cirrhosis, we have to treat them as if we are managing these patients as for variceal bleeding. Because a patient who bleeds massively from varices has a high risk of mortality. In other words, 1 in 5 patients die from variceal bleeding in the next 6 weeks if they are not managed properly. So we need to address this issue and we need to approach them as if for variceal bleeding when they present to emergency clinic. The second most important aspect, as I said, decompensated patients tend to manifest as a systemic illness. Why is that so important? When a patient with cirrhosis presents to emergency, we must understand their cardiac function is compromised, their effective circulating volume is reduced, the compensatory mechanisms which we expect in a patient, such as vasoconstriction, tachycardia, increased cardiac output to compensate for the volume loss, is compromised in patients with cirrhosis. And on top of it, all these patients are on medications such as beta blockers, diuretics, which can further deplete the volume. So in patients, when they present to hospital with GI bleeding, number one, a good history is very important, such as how many episodes of vomiting they had, what is the volume of vomiting, what time they vomited, when was their last meal, are they on any medications, such as blood thinners, are they taking medications such as blood pressure medications, beta blockers, diuretics. So this helps you to plan how you're going to resuscitate this patient. And second thing is your examination. When it comes to examination, again, as we know, cirrhosis is a systemic disease. Whenever they decompensate, there are complications which can occur following decompensation. So in your assessment, you need to first assess the volume status. Then you need to assess whether they have any infection, whether they are spiking temperature. And the last thing which you need to look for is what is their mentation like? Because anybody who develops bleeding can aspirate, can become confused, can develop hepatic encephalopathy. So you need to assess their mental status to see whether they are in a stable position to perform all these procedures. So an assessment is based on history, airway, breathing, circulation, infection, and other parameters which are crucial in planning your decision. In this particular patient, he seems to be alert. He has melena. His parameters seems to be okay. So the question here is, we resuscitate him adequately and plan for endoscopy to identify what is the source of bleeding.
Thanks so much, Dr. Ravi. If this patient's admitted under your service, what would your management principles and priorities be?
Thank you. The goal here is three things. First, we need to identify what is the cause for bleeding. Second is to prevent complications that would happen from bleeding. And the third approach would be to prevent him from having further episodes of bleeding. So this would be the goal of our treatment. Let's go step by step. Number one, we want to know what is the cause for his bleeding. So since we know he is a cirrhotic, he has his child's B, and he has an active disease from hepatitis B. So the question here is, our top differentials for bleeding in his case is going to be, number one, variceal bleed, number two, peptic ulcer bleed, or bleeding related to other portal hypertension related diseases like gastrointestinal vascular ectasia or portal hypertensive gastropathy. However, in this situation, variceal bleed would be our primary suspect. So in a ward, when we manage to see this patient, the next thing is, am I to rush and put the scope into his mouth immediately? Should this be my first step? I would say no. The first step would still be resuscitating the patient. So in his case, we need to look at his blood counts. We need to look at his blood pressure. We need to look at his heart rate. We need to look at his coagulation parameters. For instance, during a recheck of his laboratory values, if we see that his hemoglobin is low, assuming it dropped down from 9 grams to 6 grams, then that suggests that there is a significant bleeding. And we may need to top his hemoglobin up. We may need to give his fluid up. Ideally, in patients like this, we would prefer the hemoglobin to be roughly about 7 grams per deciliter, which is ideal. So we resuscitate this patient. Second important thing is, well, people would always want to see what is bleeding there, but you would want to know whether the stomach is clean for you to actually see things properly. Assuming this patient had a meal 2-3 hours ago, if I rush to put in an endoscopy into his stomach, what I'm going to see is a lot of blood clots and what he ate, which is not very helpful for me, for the patient. So in such instances, we need to keep the stomach as clean as possible. So a dose of erythromycin would be safer in clearing the stomach and the contents of the stomach. But we need to be also a bit cautious in these patients when we administer erythromycin, especially all these patients to some extent have cardiac dysfunction. It would be prudent for us to look at the ECG, look at the QTC interval, because the drugs we administer can sometimes not be ideal in conditions who have prolonged QTC, especially in erythromycin's case. It's very important we look at QTC before administering the drug. And the next important thing is any bleeding episode in patients with cirrhosis could be secondary to infection, or it could lead to infection, which again leads to further decompensation and recurrence of symptoms. So antibiotic prophylaxis is more important when we manage any kind of GI bleeding in patients with cirrhosis. In clinical practice, routinely we give ceftriaxone immediately before the procedure to decrease the risk of infection and continue it after the procedure. And last and the most key important drug which needs to be administered when we suspect patients with variceal bleeding is going to be vasoconstrictors. Why is it important? This is the only drug which is acting on the physiology that is responsible for bleeding. Here we have to control the portal pressure. The way we can control the portal pressure is by inducing vasoconstriction in the splanchnic bed. You must remember, in cirrhosis, there is splanchnic vasodilatation, which is responsible for increased portal flow. So it is prudent that we administer drugs that causes vasoconstriction and decreases the portal flow. So what are the options we have? There are three options that can be used. We can use telipressin, we can use somatostatin, or we can use octreotide. In our unit, the most common practice that we use is administering somatostatin. So we give a bolus dose of somatostatin, 250 micrograms, followed by an infusion of 250 micrograms over 24 hours. The objective here is this drug decreases the portal pressure. So as an endoscopist, when I put the endoscope to see the stomach, I don't see something that is actively spurting because the portal pressure has been lowered to an extent. So my approach in patients before planning for endoscopy is treatment targeting the pathophysiology, which is going to be somatostatin, treatment preventing infection and further decompensation, which is going to be antibiotics, and treatment facilitating easy visualization, which is going to be erythromycin. Then again, question comes, how do you know, is it ulcer bleed or variceal bleed, should we give PPI? I think there is no harm in giving proton pump inhibitors. So it's okay to administer omeprazole before procedure, although it doesn't help much with variceal bleeding, but certainly yes, if there are ulcer bleeding, that would be very much beneficial.
Thank you so much, Dr. Ravi. To summarize what you've gone through, I think it's very important to take a complete history as well as a physical examination to identify the cause of bleed, especially in patients with cirrhosis. It's very important to treat these kinds of presentations with bleeding as a variceal bleed because of the inherent mortality. We've also gone through some of the management principles as well as what are some things we can prepare for before we call for the gastroenterologist to do the endoscopy, such as starting on intravenous somatostatin or even intravenous antibiotics to reduce the risk of infections. So moving on with the case, Mr. Billy Ding is started on an IV somatostatin infusion and undergoes upper endoscopy, which reveals multiple large esophageal varices with red wheal marks. These are successfully ligated.
Okay, so Ravi, I just want to ask you a question. So as a gastroenterologist, there are two things that are just things that I can never get comfortable with, no matter how much I've done. I think the first is a liver biopsy. Just thinking of putting a needle into a vascular organ on the bedside, you feel uncomfortable. The other thing that I really struggle is the gastric varices. I think just seeing a gastric varices looking straight at me and then shoving a needle into it to inject it just feels very counterintuitive. So what are your experiences with managing gastric varices? Do you feel they are totally different from esophageal varices or requires a different skill set, a different kind of challenge? What are your thoughts?
So physiologically, both gastric varices and esophageal varices form for the same reason. But in terms of management, there is going to be a difference. In esophageal varices, the blood vessel that we are dealing with is going to be small, which is manageable with your ligation devices. But in gastric varices, that's not the case. We are going to deal with blood vessels. The number one is submucosal that are going to be big. The flow is going to be even larger than the flow that we see within esophageal blood vessel. So the treatment is going to be slightly different and slightly difficult. So before we embark on treating gastric varices, as you very well know, we need to identify what type of gastric varices are we dealing with. Because esophageal varices sometimes can extend into the stomach as a continuity. Those cases, when it extends along the lesser curvature of the stomach, which we call it as GOV1 or gastroesophageal varices type 1, they can be managed as if we are managing an esophageal varices. But on the contrary, sometimes the esophageal varices extends along the greater curvature of the stomach, which we call it as gastroesophageal varices type 2. These varices, the management is slightly different. Because along the fundus, the bulk of the varices on the gastric part is going to be bigger. So you may need to treat them with a combination of treatment. One is targeting the portion of varices in the stomach, and one is targeting the esophageal varices. And there is a third group, which is like, it has no continuity with the esophageal varices, but it just happens to be there in the fundus of the stomach. So these varices, when it happens, it could be because of increased flow from the spleen, and their management is going to be slightly different. So coming back to your question on how do we approach gastric varices. In fact, more than esophageal varices, when you need to be planning treatment for gastric varices, you need to be prepared. You need to have a mental work plan before you actually attempt to treat these varices. You need to speak to your assistants. You need to verbalize, instruct, tell them what is that you're going to do and what is that you want them to do. So in patients with gastric varices, one of the most and widely studied treatment is to actually inject glue. Glue is basically a substance which, when it comes in contact with fluid, it polymerizes and solidifies instantly. There has been a lot of debate on how I inject glue. Should I inject glue directly? Should I inject glue mixed with other solutions? Blah, 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 blah. So this debate is never ending. But from my personal experiences and the literature out there, injecting glue directly into the gastric varices is going to be the most effective and most efficient way to achieve obliteration of the flow within the gastric varices.
Thanks so much, Dr. Ravi. To summarize, you know, we've gone through some of the various treatment strategies and principles for both esophageal varices and gastric varices. I guess another very important aspect of the treatment of varices is actually the prevention or the reduction of recurrent varicial bleeds. Dr. Ravi, could you go through with us briefly about some of the principles in preventing varicial bleeds in patients with cirrhosis?
Well, this is one interesting and important concept that we need to remember. Although all the local therapies in terms of banding or glue, which we talked about, are effective, a small proportion of patients, say like 15 to 20% of patients, may fail or present again with bleeding. So what do we do now? As we mentioned, our goal of treatment is to stop the acute bleeding, prevent complication from bleeding, and the last thing is prevent re-bleeding again. So assume for this gentleman, we have done the banding and he is well in the ward. So the next goal of treatment is we don't want him to come back again with re-bleeding. So our treatment is, number one, we need to make sure we address the physiology. The physiology here is patient's portal hypertension is high. What we have done is we have only treated the local manifestation, but we have not treated the systemic cause. So how do we treat the portal hypertension? We need to initiate beta blockers in this group of patients, and we need to titrate them. The best way to titrate is if we know what the portal pressure is, then we can actually decide, titrate, dose adjust our treatment to tailor a change in the portal pressure. Not all institutes have the ability to measure portal pressure. But in our unit, we have a good working relationship with the radiologist where they can measure the portal pressure for us. So the objective of treatment is to at least achieve a 10% reduction in the portal pressure. For instance, if this gentleman's portal pressure is 20, if it's 10%, we're going to try to bring it to 18 or 16, which will actually minimize his chance of having another episode of bleeding. This is achieved by systematic titration of non-selective beta blockers. That's number one, targeting the physiology. The second aspect would be continued local therapy. Sometimes in an episode of bleeding, when we do endoscopy, we would just go and treat the acute cause of bleeding, which is if a patient has four columns of varices and if one column is bleeding, we would have treated that one particular column that has bled, but we are left with three more columns of varices that needs treatment. So we have to bring these patients in 2 weeks' time such that we can systematically eradicate the remaining columns of esophageal varices while we titrate the beta blockers. So that should be our goal to treat the pathophysiology and goal to offer local treatment. And most of these patients tend to stay in the hospital for 3 to 5 days. And what happens to them in these 3 to 5 days is we take our utmost effort to bring down the portal pressure by continuing them on somatostatin. We prevent them from having a bout of infection. So we continue them with antibiotics for at least 5 days to a week. And then we send them home with all these necessary medications. So it's important. It's not like just stopping the acute episode of bleeding. It's also important for us to prevent these patients from having another episode of bleeding or prevent them from dying within 6 weeks of a bleed. That should be our goal.
I guess another question that I'd like to ask would be for patients who are diagnosed with cirrhosis but haven't had an episode of variceal bleeding, how do we decide who requires primary screening and prevention for these groups of patients?
So when we talk about primary prophylaxis, the easiest way to approach this is cirrhosis, no clinically significant portal hypertension, the need for beta blocker is questionable. Cirrhosis with clinically significant portal hypertension manifested by varices either in endoscopy or scans, then we go and target the pathophysiology by giving them beta blockers. So we can dichotomize them into this two groups to make our practice easier.
Thank you so much, Dr. Ravi. I think you've really gone through in very great detail as to what are some of the strategies for primary prevention, primary prophylaxis, as well as secondary prevention of variceal bleeding. So before we conclude, Dr. Ravi, do you have any clinical pearls of wisdom that you'd like to share with some of our listeners who may have come across patients with variceal bleeding in the wards?
Oh, yeah. Let's go to the learning points now, which is the most important aspect. Patients with cirrhosis, when they bleed, we need to approach them carefully and we need to focus them and attend to them immediately because their resources to begin with are very limited. The window of opportunity for us to revive this group of patients is always going to be small. So whenever somebody calls you while you're on call saying the patient with cirrhosis is actually bleeding, vomiting, you just go and attend to them. You replace fluids, you resuscitate them before calling an endoscopies. And you must initiate all the medications that we discussed earlier to stabilize them before we even perform endoscopy. So always approach a patient with cirrhosis as a systemic disease. And then your management is going to be holistic because these patients are going to develop multi-organ dysfunction if not cared for properly. And the treatment doesn't stop just with stopping the bleeding. The treatment is going to be like even beyond bleeding. These patients need to be cared appropriately until they leave the hospital or even after the hospital. So a proper planning, proper attention to patient symptoms, a proper attention to patient's labs, resuscitation, and a good follow-up plan is what is going to keep these patients alive in the coming months after an episode of GI bleeding.
Thank you so much, Dr. Ravi, for your time.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me. It was a pleasure.
To our listeners, thank you for tuning in to another episode of Guts and Glory. Stay tuned and look out for our next episode.